the United Kingdom under the only three kings who ever ruled over all the tribes of Israel: Saul, David, and Solomon. Last week we thought about the breakup of the kingdom when the nation in about 930 BC divided along tribal lines into two separate kingdoms called Israel in the north and Judah in the south. And we traced the history of the northern kingdom, Israel, from its first king, Jeroboam I, to its final destruction at the hands of the Assyrians in 722 BC. Today we turn to the southern kingdom of Judah and look at its history. From the formation of the separate kingdom of Judah, again of course in about 930 BC, to the destruction of Judah by the Babylonians in 587 BC. I bring us, we'd better just pass those around, hadn't we? I hadn't thought of that since we're not having a hymn. Now, I have once tried to give a lecture going through these 350 years of Judah's history chronologically, but it didn't work. Catherine was one of my students at that time, and she will tell you that it ended up as a jumble of facts, kings, and dates. So what I intend to do instead tonight is to look at four themes from this period. And the first is the vital question: was the king true to the Lord? The reigns of the kings of Judah are described in the books of 1 and 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, supplemented by considerable sections of historical material in the prophetic books of Isaiah and Jeremiah. As each king is introduced in the books of Kings and Chronicles, they are evaluated in the same way. And I would like you, please, to turn to 1 Kings chapter 15. Could turn you to almost any chapter. 1 Kings chapter 15, just to look at some examples. Look first at 1 Kings 15, verse 1. Now, in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, son of Nebat, that is, Jeroboam the first of Israel, Abijam began to reign over Judah. Sounds a bit like a supermarket, doesn't he? Now here is the evaluation of his reign. Verse 3. He committed all the sins that his father did before him. His heart was not true to the Lord his God, like the heart of his father David. Now let's look at his successor. Verse 9. In the 20th year of King Jeroboam, the first of Israel, Asa began to reign over Judah. And again his evaluation, verse 11, Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, as his father, incidentally his father there means his, he was probably his great-grandfather, his ancestor, David, had done. So you see, the cardinal question for the biblical writers is not, was the king politically successful in domestic and international affairs, but was he true to the Lord, or was he faithless? And the criterion for deciding that is largely whether he eliminated all forms of pagan worship and, as far as possible, concentrated all worship in the Temple of Jerusalem, or whether he allowed pagan practices to seep back in, or even fostered them. If an American were to ask, who were the great kings and queens of England, we'd be inclined to say, wouldn't we, Elizabeth I, because she stood up to Spain, or Victoria, because of the great days of the British Empire, or perhaps George VI, because with Churchill as Prime Minister, we stood alone against Hitler. None of that would impress the biblical writers at all. They might say our greatest kings were Edward the Confessor because of his piety, and Edward the Sixth because the prayer book was at its most biblical then, or even the Republic under Oliver Cromwell. And that our worst monarchs were not just Mary, who tried to reverse the return to the Bible, but the Georges, because the 18th century was such a period of moral laxity and spiritual decline. I shudder to think what they would say of England's leadership in the entire 20th century. But which is more important in our national life? Economic strength, the Dow managing to creep over 10,000, or faithfulness to God? So each king is judged as being either true or faithless to God. Now there's a list of all the kings. I tried to put a longer line for a longer reign. The dates, by the way, are approximate and maybe up to 10 years wrong. And against each, I've put the Bible's evaluation. For each, I have put, or rather for ease's sake, I've put true in capitals, if they were true to the Lord, and faithless in upper and lower case, if they were false to the Lord. Now, broadly, you can see there that Judah got off to a bad start in the years from about 950 to 908, with the later reign of Solomon, who's of course not on that list because this is only of Judah, but you'll remember that he married many foreign wives and through them introduced the worship of foreign gods. And with his son Rehoboam, the first king of Judah, and his grandson Abijam. Judah then had a good middle from about 908 to 743, with a series of kings who were largely true to the Lord, except that Jehoshaphat, a good king, made the fatal mistake of marrying his son Jehoram to Athaliah, who was the daughter of the infamous Ahab of Israel. So that there was a period of faithlessness to the Lord from 851 to 836 under Jehoram, his son Ahaziah, and then the queen mum, Athaliah, who usurped the throne and bumped off the rest of her family, only one escaping. But Judah had a disastrous final century, from 698 to 587, when her kings were almost uniformly in favor of an admixture of pagan worship, with the single glorious exception of Josiah, who reigned from 639 to 609. That, as I say, is the broad picture. As you would expect, it wasn't quite as straightforward as that. Kings could and did change. The best sometimes became proud and moved away from the Lord. The worst occasionally repented and came back to the Lord. Nevertheless, the broad brush picture holds good. Within this whole history, there were two special heroes and one special villain. The first special hero was Hezekiah, 727 to 698. It might be good to turn to his introduction, 2 Kings now, chapter 18. And while you do that, let me tell you that the dates on here are one scholar's approach, they can be anything up to 10 years wrong. In most cases, they'll only be up to 2 or 3 years wrong. And don't be surprised that some reigns overlap. This is because of co-regencies. So let me give you his introduction. 2 Kings 18, verses 1 to 8. In the third year of King Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of King Ahaz, son of King Ahaz of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Abi, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, just as his ancestor David had done. He removed the high places, broke down the pillars, and cut down the sacred pole. He broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings to it. It was called Nehushtan. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was no one like him among all the kings of Judah after him, or among all those who went before him. For he held fast to the Lord. He did not depart from following him, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. The Lord was with him. Wherever he went, he prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He attacked the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. Now, why did the writer of 2 Kings admire him so much? Well, he got rid of much idolatrous worship. Verse 4 tells us that he destroyed the paganized high places, the pillars, probably a symbol of a male Canaanite god, and the sacred pole, a symbol of Asherah, the main female goddess. And he broke up Moses' bronze serpent, which was now being worshipped. Then he held fast to the Lord. Verse 6. He did not depart from following the Lord, but kept the commandments that the Lord commanded Moses. In particular, he reopened the temple, which had been partly shut by his predecessor, cleansed it from many of the pagan objects that had been put in it, and celebrated a great Passover in Jerusalem. And he saw off the Assyrian threat. Verse 7 says that he rebelled against the king of Assyria, which had first, in fact, proved disastrous because the Assyrians overran most of the country. But fortified by the prophet Isaiah, he was able to encourage his own army by saying, "Don't be afraid before the king of Assyria, for there is one greater with us than with him. With him is an arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles." And while the northern kingdom of Israel had, of course, been obliterated by the Assyrians, God did indeed save Judah from their hands. The second special hero in the books of Kings and Chronicles is Josiah, one of the last kings, who reigned from 639 to 609. In particular, he is celebrated for three things. First, he engaged in wholesale uprooting of idolatry and idolatrous practices, much more radical than any of his predecessors, and even extending to the area of the now defunct northern kingdom. For instance, destroying the infamous shrine that Jeroboam I, you may remember, had set up at Bethel. Second, he repented deeply when the book of the law was found in the temple. And for this important event, perhaps you would turn to 2 Kings chapter 22. Look at verse 3 to start with. In the 18th year of King Josiah, the king sent Shaphan, the secretary, to arrange repairs to the temple. During the course of the repairs, verse 8, the high priest Hilkiah said to Shaphan the secretary, I found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. When Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, he read it. And the book was then, incidentally, this was some part of the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, or Deuteronomy, quite likely all or part of Deuteronomy, which had become so neglected that it had been forgotten. The book was read to Josiah. Now, verse 11. When the king heard the words of the book of the law, he tore his clothes. And he said, verse 13, go inquire of the Lord for me, for the people, and for all Judah, concerning the words of this book that has been found. For great is the wrath of the Lord that is kindled against us, because our ancestors did not obey the words of this book to do according to all that is written concerning us. He set about in his own life and in the life of the nation, obeying what was written in this newly discovered book of God's law. Chapter 23, verse 3, the next chapter, verse 3. The king stood by the pillar and made a covenant before the Lord to follow the Lord, keeping his commandments, his decrees, and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people joined in the covenant. And as one important sign of this, he celebrated a glorious Passover festival recounted in lavish detail in 2 Chronicles 35, and thereby fulfilled one of the commandments of the law. Now, this reform of his is, of course, what happened at the time of the Reformation on the continent of Europe and in Britain. The Bible was rediscovered as the authoritative source of God's will and God's revelation of himself. It was put into the hands of laymen and laywomen instead of being confined to the priests. All who could read were encouraged to read it. And the whole life of the church and of individual committed Christians was reorientated around the promises and teachings of this book. It's a fundamental way of life never to be abandoned. To learn about God and to learn to obey God from the Bible and the Bible alone. There's also in these books one king from among all the faithful ones, faithless ones rather, who is singled out as a special villain. It's this one here, Manasseh. He had a 55-year reign. His line really should be a little bit longer, from 698 to 642. Sadly, he was the son of a very good king of Hezekiah. Perhaps you turn back a page, or perhaps two, to chapter 21, verses 1 to 18, where his reign is described. He not only encouraged pagan worship by, verse 3, erecting altars to Baal and a sacred pole as a representation of the goddess Asherah, but he practiced idolatrous worship in the very temple of God. Verse 5. He built altars for the host of heaven, that is the sun, the moon, and the stars, in the two courts of the house of the Lord. And again, verse 7. The carved image of Asherah that he had made, he set in the house of which the Lord said to David and to his son Solomon, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. Rather like putting a gigantic statue of Ganesh, the Hindu elephant god, right in the middle of Westminster Abbey or of St. Paul's Cathedral. he made a sacrifice of his own son in pagan worship. Verse 6 says, he made his son pass through fire, which means that he sacrificed his own child by burning him to death on the altar of some pagan deity whom he was trying to appease. This practice is mentioned several times in the Old Testament, which considered it, of course, anathema. And as a result of this, and his many other sins, God said, as the end of second half of verse 13 puts it, I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. I will cast off the remnant of my heritage and give them into the hand of their enemies. They shall become a prey and a spoil to all their enemies. Manasseh, you see, was the southern kingdom's equivalent of Ahab and Jezebel in the north. And his sins were just about the last straw as far as God was concerned. And so we move more briefly to three other themes in the southern kingdom's history. And the next is David. David, of course, lived outside the period we're considering tonight, because he ruled before the kingdom was divided. But he remained, for the biblical writers, the benchmark of loyalty to the Lord. In the northern kingdom last week, we saw that the benchmark of unfaithfulness was Jeroboam the First, so that we frequently hear of northern kings, quote, he walked in the way of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. In the southern kingdom, by contrast, there is a benchmark of loyalty to the Lord, and it is King David. You may like to turn on to chapter 22, verse 2, for an example. Here it said of Josiah, I've turned on one too many pages, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord and walked in all the way of his father David. He didn't turn aside to the right or to the left. The same benchmark can be used negatively. Of Ahaz, it is said, he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his ancestor David had done. 2 Kings 16:2. And a modified judgment can be given. Of Amaziah, it said, he did what was right in the sight of the Lord, yet not like his ancestor David. Here is a position in our family to aspire to. How wonderful if our children could say of us, Catherine and me, that, speaking of themselves, we did what was right in the eyes of the Lord as our parents did. And our grandchildren could say, we walked in the way of the Lord like our ancestors, Andrew and Catherine. But to be able to say that, we need to be like David, who, as 1 Kings 15:5 says, did what was right in the sight of the Lord and did not turn aside from anything that the Lord commanded him all the days of his life. Though 1 Kings has to add, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. And another important theme connected with David is God's covenant with David's family. We've referred again and again to God's covenant with David, in which he promised through the prophet Nathan, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. That is indeed what happened. Starting from David himself, we can say that the throne passed from father to son for over 400 years, with the single exception of when the queen mum, Athaliah, usurped the throne and for a very short time it passed out. Not exactly the family, because she was married to a Davidite, but still she wasn't of the Davidic line, of course, herself. And this was all the more remarkable because several of the kings were not liked and were murdered. But whereas in the northern kingdom, as we saw last week, the murder of a king led to a new dynasty, in the southern kingdom, a murder simply led to the king's son being placed on the throne. God's covenant with David is also given on several occasions as the reason why God didn't bring Judah to an end much earlier. Despite the evil of some kings, quote, "The Lord would not destroy Judah for the sake of his servant David, since he had promised to give a lamp to him and to his descendants forever." A third theme I want to explore is the northern kingdom. Judah's northern neighbor, incorporating the other Israelite tribes, from which the tribes of Judah and part of Benjamin had been cut off. If David was the benchmark in Judah for faithfulness to the Lord, then the northern kingdom was one benchmark of disloyalty to the Lord for Judah. If Kings or Chronicles want to say that a king has been faithless, then one particularly damning way is to say that he was like the Israelite kings, particularly if Ahab is mentioned. So, for example, of Jehoram, he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as the house of Ahab had done. For the daughter of Ahab, that is, of course, Athaliah, was his wife. The northern kingdom was also a nation to be shunned. In a number of periods, Judah and Israel were at war with each other. But there were occasions when they cooperated, especially during the reign of Jehoshaphat. Normally, this was an alliance greeted with hostility by those most loyal to the Lord, precisely because the northern kingdom was so deeply compromised by pagan practices. So a prophet says to Jehoshaphat, "Should you help the wicked and love those who hate the Lord?" This is his alliance with the northern kingdom. "Because of this, wrath has gone out against you from the Lord." But it's important to add that the northern kingdom was also a people to claim back. Judah never lost its sense that the northern tribes were people to be won back to the true worship of the Lord, and that rather as with North and South Korea today, reunification was the ultimate goal. So we saw last week that when the United Kingdom divided, it was not only the tribe of Judah and part of Benjamin and many of the tribe of Levi who constituted the South, but also, to quote 2 Chronicles, those northerners who had set their hearts to seek the Lord of God of Israel came with the Levites from the tribes of Israel to Jerusalem to sacrifice to the Lord, the God of their ancestors. So right from the beginning, some Orthodox northerners came south. It's a very good journey to make, actually, from the north to the south. And so people who go from the south to the north, they need to be in big trouble, really. Probably going to pagan practices up there. And from time to time, the southern kings tried to woo them back, especially after the destruction of the northern kingdom in 722 BC and its incorporation into the Assyrian Empire. So Hezekiah sent messengers throughout the northern territory saying, "O people of Israel, return to the Lord. For the Lord your God is gracious and merciful and will not turn his face from you if you return to them, to him. He invited them specifically to come and celebrate the Passover in Jerusalem. I have to say the result was not encouraging. Most of the northerners laughed the messengers to scorn. And I quote, "Only a few from Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem." Josiah was bolder still. He seems to have gained some control over the northern lands, and therefore removed idolatrous altars and images, not only from Judah, but, I quote, "from Manasseh, Ephraim, and Simeon, and as far as Naphtali." This same dual emphasis is very similar to how the New Testament teaches us we Christians should regard the world around us. On the one hand, our behavior and our beliefs are to be radically different from those around us. We should have fundamentally different ideas, whether about Jesus Christ or about war with Serbia. And too close association with non-Christians, for example, in close business partnerships, is to be seen as at least dangerous. On the other hand, it should never leave our minds for a moment that many of our friends and neighbors are, to use the language of the New Testament, without Christ, aliens from the new Israel, that is, the family of the church, having no hope, and without God in the world. And we should leave no stone unturned to woo them back. And so finally, with a page to go, to a fourth theme I call the two great crises. And the first I call the Assyrians and Hezekiah. We saw last week that the Assyrians first made the northern kingdom of Israel their vassal state, and then finally destroyed the northern kingdom in 722 BC. By that stage, Judah had already become an Assyrian client state, acknowledging Assyrian overlordship, but not occupied by Assyrian troops. In 704, a new king, Sennacherib, came to the Assyrian throne. Shortly afterwards, Hezekiah rebelled. And in 701, Sennacherib marched on Judah. He took most of the country, and as his own records tell us, we have his records for this campaign, he shut up Hezekiah, I quote Sennacherib, "like a bird in a cage." But Isaiah, having rebuked Hezekiah initially for relying on political alliances, especially with Egypt, brought Hezekiah a reassuring message from the Lord when Jerusalem was under siege. I quote, "The king of Assyria shall not come into this city. By the way that he came, by the same he shall return. For I will defend this city to save it, for my own sake, and for the sake of my servant David." And so it proved to be, probably on a human level, from a mixture of two factors, a rumor that all was not well in the Assyrian homeland, and an outbreak of plague among the Assyrian army. This was a crisis which, with God's help, Judah survived. Very different was the second crisis. The Babylonians and the three last kings of Judah, Jehoiakim, his son Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah. The Assyrian Empire, so extraordinarily powerful at the end of the 8th century and for much of the 7th century, I can come over here for a moment, this is its heartland up here, but all the area in both dark and light green, this vast area here, including Egypt, and of course the Sinai Desert, that was all under Assyrian control in 635 BC. And then suddenly, the whole empire came crashing down. In 612, only 20 years later than what I've just shown you, its capital, Nineveh, was taken. The Babylonians were the new world power. And in 604 or 603, Babylonians, incidentally, from exactly the same kind of area, in fact, just a little bit further, further east, Babylon is there, in that little purple blob there. Syria's heartland here, Babylon there, a little bit further away from Judah. But as I say, in 604 to 603, Jehoiakim was made a Judah was made a vassal state of Babylon, and he, and later his brother and successor Zedekiah, revolted against the Babylonians, and the result was disaster. In 597, Jerusalem was taken, and much of Judah's population deported. And in 587, after a further rebellion, Jerusalem was again taken, the temple, palace, and walls of the city destroyed. Zedekiah had his sons killed before his eyes, before he himself had his eyes gouged out. And the kingdom of Judah was, to all intents and purposes, over. These tragic events can be explained politically. But there was an underlying religious reason which 2 Chronicles 36 puts in this way. The Lord, the God of their ancestors, sent persistently to them by his messengers because he had compassion on his people and on his dwelling place, that's the temple. But they kept mocking the messengers of God, despising his words and scoffing at his prophets, until the wrath of the Lord against his people became so great that there was no remedy. Please God, we will listen to the preachers of God's word before we get to that point in British society and in the British church. Well, we'll take our break at that point.